Hello and welcome to AUP Radio, a melting pot of voices and ideas brought to you by World Radio Paris. Tonight we have two shows coming up. We'll start off with Have You Heard? And then move on to Existentially Inclined. Enjoy!
Welcome to Have You Heard, a weekly rundown and analysis of the top news in U.S. and world politics. So the next time a water cooler conversation starts with Have You Heard, you can say yes. I'm Jacob Shropshire.
And I'm Erin Flanagan. This week we're going to be going over the announcement of a new coalition government in Germany, a Russian troop buildup near Ukraine, what's going on with OPEC, and I wrap up with a potential diplomatic boycott of the Winter Olympics in Beijing.
Just a quick disclaimer, all views and opinions expressed in this show represent our personal views and not that of any organization we're affiliated with.
Last week, Germany announced that the Social Democrats, Greens, and Liberals had agreed on a deal to form the country's next government with Olaf Scholz as chancellor.
It is the end of an era, Erin. End of Angela Merkel.
Absolutely. This new alliance signals the end of 16 years of a conservative-led government under Angela Merkel, who did not run for another term in this election.
So what should we know about this new coalition government?
Yeah, so these three parties have never governed Germany together, and actually Germany is also used to only having a two-partner coalition. So this whole thing is a bit of an experiment and a little bit new for Germany, which has seen a remarkably stable political system under Merkel's leadership. So Jake, tell us a little bit about her up-and-coming Scholz.
Yeah, so the new chancellor, Olaf Scholz, he's 63 years old, and he was the finance minister under Merkel's outgoing coalition. He led the Social Democrats to victory under this most recent election, and he really needed to seal a deal with the Greens and the Free Democrats to ensure that he'd be the chancellor, and he succeeded in that, and so now he's going to be the chancellor. The new government should take office later next month. What are they going to be prioritizing in their new government?
So as you can imagine, each partner is bringing in its own priorities. For example, the Social Democrats are really interested in raising the minimum wage. You've got the Greens, who want to phase out coal power by 2030, which would be several years earlier than anticipated. And then you have the Free Dems, who are interested in maintaining fiscal discipline. So quite a range there. They do have some shared priorities. For example, they want to liberalize some citizenship laws to allow for dual nationality, improving gay and transgender rights, lowering the voting age to 16, and legalizing recreational cannabis. There's also a big emphasis on making things less bureaucratic, which I think living in France, you and I can appreciate.
Yes, absolutely.
They're trying to remove a lot of hurdles and barriers that prevent things from getting done in an efficient manner, which is very German. And of course, this is all coming in the middle of rising COVID numbers, so that's going to be their first priority, no doubt about it.
Yeah, these groups aren't necessarily natural allies, that's for sure. You know, free Dems are really about like free markets and low taxes. The Greens are focused on environmental issues and social equality. And the fact that they're able to come together and form this government is a big deal, but it's going to take a lot of compromise going forward.
And on the other side of things, Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats are really trying to figure out who is going to lead and what happened after they suffered their worst election defeat, the worst election results ever. So, Jake, what does that mean for Germany's place on the world stage?
Well, Merkel has really been a consistent partner for the U.S. and has turned Germany into a leading voice in Europe. She's been held up as an example for the way she's managed to a number of crises over the years. So there's definitely going to be a little bit of a void as she leaves.
Yeah, and Scholz is shifting German leadership from the center right that Germany's been used to for the last 16 years under Merkel to more of a center left. But he has indicated that shift will be mostly felt in domestic policy and that foreign policy will mostly remain unchanged. He's recommitted to NATO after a few years of a strained relationship around defense spending. You might remember Trump threatened to pull 12,000 troops from Germany. Biden did put this on the back burner. But Berlin is slowly increasing its defense spending all the same.
Yeah, it's worth noting that on that first point, the center right in Germany is pretty close to the center left or maybe even middle left in the U.S. But when it comes to international, you know, politics, you know, this is all coming amidst rising tensions between Russia and NATO. And of course, Germany is part of NATO. So it's a big deal. On to our next thing.
Speaking of Russia and NATO.
Yeah.
In recent weeks, there has been a large and, according to experts, unusual buildup of Russian troops near its border with the Ukraine. It has NATO and the United States really concerned, with Kiev claiming, that's the capital of Ukraine, about 90,000 Russian soldiers and heavy equipment, including tanks, have been repositioned close to the Ukraine.
So what reactions are we seeing to all this?
Let's start off with NATO. So NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg is urging the Kremlin to be transparent about its military activities. This also comes amidst accusations that Moscow was involved with the migrant crisis we talked about a few weeks ago on the border between Poland and Belarus. The U.S. is also closely monitoring the Ukraine region with officials concerned over the unexplained movements of Russian military units. So, Jake, can you tell us a bit more about the recent history between Ukraine and Russia that will help us understand the situation a bit more?
Yeah, so there's a conflict ongoing in eastern Ukraine, which began in 2014. This was between the Ukraine forces and Russia-backed separatists. This followed the illegal annexation of the Crimean Peninsula in 2014 and resulted in stiff Western sanctions on the country. NATO is just one of the latest allies to express concern over the Russian troop movements, and this troop increase is the largest since the 2014 annexation. What is Russia saying with all this?
True to form, the Kremlin's being pretty coy. They've repeatedly said that any troop movements in Russia territory are its own business, and they will maintain a troop presence where they deem necessary. They have said they're not planning an invasion, but experts say that Putin wants Ukraine and sees it as a central component to his vision of Russia's future.
There are reports out there that the U.S. has talked to allies about a possibility of a Russian invasion, but Russia has pushed back against this, saying that, quote, they never planned, never did, and is never going to do it, meaning an invasion, unless we are provoked by Ukraine or by somebody else, which is a great quote.
Nice little caveat there at
yeah.
the end. And of course, that's not true, because they did invade Ukraine in 2014. And plus, there's a lot of concern about what Russia views as a provocation that it could use as a rationale for doing whatever it is that they want to do. So Russia recently pointed to U.S. Navy activities in the Black Sea. So tell us a bit more about that, Jake.
Yeah, so the U.S. recently participated in some naval exercises with some partner countries in the Black Sea. Russia referred to this as a defiant action near its borders and that it's actions like this that force it to be on guard. Something about how there's a lot of room for miscalculation, I don't really know.
Yeah, and the U.S. is not assuming that this is a bluff. U.S. and British intel are increasingly convinced that Russian President Vladimir Putin is considering military action either to take control of a larger portion of the country or to destabilize it enough to bring in a Moscow-friendly government.
And it's worth remembering that this isn't happening in a political vacuum. There's a lot of flux in Europe right now. I mean, we just talked about how Angela Merkel is leaving office. So as this new government is establishing itself, that leaves sort of a leadership void. You know, rising energy prices making Europe more dependent on Russia for gas supplies and like fear of losing access could limit European support for tougher sanctions. We'll talk about that a little bit more here in a minute. And then like rising prices and limited supplies giving Russia more money to pay for military operations.
Not to mention going back to the migrant crisis on the border between Belarus and Poland, some have accused Putin of taking part in it. He does have a history of using events to advance his own interests, so some think that he might be using the migrant crisis to divert attention away from troop movements near Ukraine.
Yeah, the West is looking to work together. Something about the importance of being on the same page will bring the risk down if the Kremlin sees a united front, ready to act if they take military action.
And the U.S. is definitely looking to Europe for support because without them, any sanctions will be a lot less effective. The U.S. is warning Russia of a strong reaction from the West, and they really need Europe to actually back that warning up. They're also concerned about looking tough without escalating and further endangering the people of Ukraine, because it's important to remember that more than 14,000 people have died in the conflict since 2014. And this is not the first time Russia has built up troops like this. In the spring, Russia amassed troops on the border. They were eventually pulled out after President Biden held a summit with Putin. And a virtual meeting between Biden and Putin is expected before the end of the year. So we'll see if there's a similar result.
Now we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more Have You Heard?
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to AUP Radio, brought to you by World Radio Paris. Now back to Have You Heard?
Welcome back to Have You Heard? Last week, President Biden announced that the U.S., along with China, India, South Korea, Japan, and Britain, would be selling off oil from their Strategic Petroleum Reserves, or SPR for short. Jake, what exactly is the SPR?
Well, the SPR is pretty simple. It's kind of like the Department of Energy's version of Fort Knox. It's a whole bunch of big oil container buildings. They're like these big oil silos, basically. In Texas and Louisiana along the coast, they hold around 620 million barrels of crude oil, which is one of the world's largest petroleum reserves. And it's enough. That's enough oil to keep the U.S. running for a month if all imports completely stopped. It was originally established after there was this big oil embargo in the 70s by Arab oil exporters. And it's really designed for emergencies. So hurricanes during the Persian Gulf War in 1991, it was tapped. And so that's really the goal for it. And there's a little bit of debate around using it right now. Some people, Chuck Schumer is kind of one of the leading voices here, but there were, I think, 11 Senate Democrats who were saying this as well. They were saying that inflation was a good enough reason to use it, since high gas prices have been affecting normal families, and selling off some of that oil in the SPR would put more supply in the system, and in theory, at least, it would lower the price. Others are saying that releasing oil, it wouldn't be very effective, and that this maneuver should be saved for like hurricanes, those emergencies that we were talking about. And they were calling this as a political stunt. Why did Biden make this call?
There seem to be really two reasons why, you know, behind his decision. First and most obvious, there's the politics of it. Oil and gas prices have been going up, and inflation has been linked to Biden's falling approval rating. So tapping the SPR means that whether or not it works, he can say he's actually doing the things within his power to lower the price of gas. And secondly, though this gives him an opportunity to put some pressure on OPEC, which is the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, think countries like Russia, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Venezuela, Biden has been pushing them to increase their oil production to combat the rising prices, but they've pretty much refused to raise their production. So this move is a proverbial shot across the bow for these countries. And since it was such a coordinated effort with other countries, it's hard to push back too forcefully.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning that OPEC Plus is actually meeting this week. They have a monthly meeting, which is happening, I believe, on Wednesday this week. And so we'll see then, you know, what, if anything, they decide to do as a way of pushing back. Most everything so far is just speculation, to be clear, but they've been slowly increasing their oil production by 400,000 barrels of oil per day each month. And some people are speculating that they're going to stop that growth as sort of a pushback. This would obviously put pretty big wrench in the works when it comes to solving the inflation problem that Biden's trying to solve. I will also say, though, that politically it could be beneficial as long as the Biden administration finds another way to lower the price of gas. I don't think anyone really needs polling to prove that countries like Russia, Saudi Arabia, or the UAE are exactly popular places in the U.S. And so Biden sort of targeting those as geopolitical conflict, it could be politically beneficial. But there's also a little bit of a question about, like, is this Biden's version of, like, Trump's sanctions on China? Obviously, clearly less reckless. There's still a little bit of a question about that. All politics aside, though, Aaron, does it look like this is even going to work?
Bad news for you out there with this SUV, but so far it's not looking like it. On these kinds of things, it's always a big expectations game. And there's been hints that the Biden administration would be releasing some oil from the SPR. And investors were thinking something closer to 100 million barrels, not the 50 million Biden is releasing. And there's also the thing we talked about where if OPEC Plus ends up stopping their growth in oil exports, it could cause some bigger problems. That said, even people who are skeptical of the move are saying it will at least offer some temporary effects. And the hope is that this will be enough to get people through next spring, which is when analysts think gas prices will naturally go back down.
Yeah, the good news with all of this, at least, is that the environmental impacts of less oil, less oil there is, the better it is for the environment. So my personal hope is that this makes electric vehicles a little bit more popular in the U.S. On to our next topic. Earlier this month, Chinese tennis player Peng Shui took to Weibo, Chinese version of Twitter, to accuse China's former vice premier, Sheng Gaoli, of sexually assaulting her and coercing her into an affair. After making the post, Peng disappeared for 3 weeks, and last week she reappeared through a video released by the Chinese state and then met virtually with the International Olympic Committee president, who said she was fine. Aaron, do you buy it?
Not a chance. It's pretty obvious that the video of her in this meeting with the IOC president are staged, because there was a lot of pressure for the public to see her. And it's really disappointing to see the IOC acting like this and kind of caving into those Chinese demands. The crazy thing is that everyone pretty much knows that this is going to happen when you post up something like this. And that's a lot of what made her post so brave, because she likely knew to some degree the consequences of her action.
Yeah, it was undoubtedly an extremely brave move from her. And this says a lot about what the Chinese state is willing and what they're not willing to do when it comes to social issues, even if they think they're popular. The Chinese government has been making these pledges and legal changes for a while now that are designed to reduce sexual assault and violence against women. They haven't all been very effective, and they've also targeted like feminist groups and done stuff like that, which are obviously harmful to these goals. This has put even more pressure on the upcoming Olympics in Beijing next year. The original boycotts of the Olympics were based around human rights abuses of the Uyghur Muslim minority in the Xinjiang province. Some governments have already declared diplomatic boycotts. The EU and the UK have done that. The US is also saying, President Biden was saying that he's considering doing a diplomatic boycott as well. So, this is just moving the needle in that direction.
Yeah, and full-on boycotts of the Olympics are generally just difficult calls to make. If a country does a full-on boycott of the Olympics, it's really putting all those athletes and the training they've done on hold. These are people who spend literally their entire lives practicing for the things that they're competing in. And you have big features in culture that just don't get to compete, things Simone Biles, Shaun White. So it isn't as clear-cut as some might think.
Yeah, I think these diplomatic boycotts are definitely the right way to go. It means that, no high-ranking diplomats will attend the games. The president won't be there. The secretary of state won't be there, people like that. But it still lets athletes compete and do the things that they're really wanting to do. More broadly, I think governments around the world need to figure out some ways to put pressure on China for human rights abuses. Some of this should be market pressure. I think that's important. But we also saw a lot of kickback when companies tried to protest the treatment of Uyghurs. There was like nationwide boycotts in China earlier this year and last year. So that's problematic. And I think the U.S. could incentivize people making these moves to sort of counterbalance that in hope. There should also be governmental moves. And I'm not exactly sure what this looks like. Clearly, economic sanctions have limited effects. We saw that in the Trump era that these economic sanctions didn't work perfectly well. But my hope is that, there are people better at this than us who are working on figuring out a solution, figuring out ways to put some governmental pressure and geopolitical pressure on China to solve these issues, because they're real issues.
One can only hope. We had a really international show for you all today, but now we're going to switch gears for our quick news update.
Following up on our coverage of the trial of three men convicted of killing Ahmaud Arbery, Travis McMichael, Greg McMichael, and William Roddy Bryan were found guilty of murder, aggravated assault, and false imprisonment by a nearly all-white jury. The three men are awaiting sentencing, facing life in prison without parole. They will also face a federal hate crime trial next year.
At least 31 migrants heading to Britain died last week when their boat sank in the English Channel. The migrants had left from France, and their nationalities are still unknown. This year alone, an estimated 25,700 migrants have tried to make the perilous journey across the channel, hoping to reach Britain. Both countries have been at odds over how to manage the crossings, with both blaming the other for not doing enough.
Everyone's two least favorite words, new variant, popped up again this week as new fears mount over the recently identified Omicron variant. The new mutation is potentially more transmissible, but there is a lot we still don't know yet. Some countries are re-implementing travel bans, especially from several countries in southern Africa where the variant was first discovered. Scientists are saying that more research needs to be done to understand if the Omicron variant is actually more transmissible or if we'll be able to even evade vaccines. We'll keep an eye on this going forward, but hopefully early detection by scientists in South Africa will help the world respond quickly.
Last week, a federal jury found CVS, Walgreens, and Walmart liable for helping fuel the U.S. opioid crisis, which will have legal repercussions for thousands of similar cases being brought across the country. These companies were found liable for selling and dispensing enormous quantities of prescription pain pills. Damages will likely run into the billions of dollars.
All right, all right, all right. There's been a shakeup in the race for the governorship of Texas. Matthew McConaughey has announced that he will not be running for office, leaving the field open for a contest between Democrat Beto O'Rourke and Republican incumbent Greg Abbott. Guess we'll never know how to lose a governorship in 10 days.
Ooh.
That's all we have for this week. If you want to continue the conversation, you can hit us up on Twitter. I'm at JD Shropshire.
And I'm at Erin K. Flanagan, also responsible for the how to lose a governorship in 10 days.
Yes, yeah, she wrote that.
That was not Jake. This has been Have You Heard? We'll talk to you next week.
See you next week.
Good afternoon. This is Fiona McMurray with the show Existentially Inclined. Today, I'm joined by Professor Julien Culp from the American University of Paris, and we will be discussing his recent paper, Democratic Citizenship Education in Digitized Societies, a Habermasian Approach. Now, this is part of my series on digitization and how it's going to affect not only philosophy, but also essentially all aspects of human life, as we move from the Anthropocene to the Technocene. And Professor Culp has outlined very interestingly through a Habermasian approach the way in which digitization will be affecting democracy on at the level of education, but also at different legislative levels, and also as a pathology in and of, or a communicative pathology, and also how it produces those. So I guess to start us off, Professor, what sort of initiated your interest in digitized societies in relation to citizenship and also education?
First of all, thanks very much for the invitation to speak here today. My motivation to talk about and write about this topic of citizenship education in the context of digitized societies is that there's a lot of literature out there already talking about the importance of digital literacy and digital citizenship and how students should be educated so as to fulfill their responsibilities when they are acting and communicating online. And what struck me when reading this literature is that it is narrowly focused on the communicative practices that take place digitally and online. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the literature doesn't really take account of the wider cultural and economic changes that are taking place in the background, so mm-hmm. to speak, and that are very important to keep in mind and to analyze when making proposals as to how citizenship education should be conceived in the future, since the economic and cultural background conditions also have a profound effect on the democratic quality of our political systems. And this democratic quality, which I think is in decline in many countries, also needs to be taken seriously when thinking about citizenship education. So it's been a certain dissatisfaction with the existing literature on digital citizenship and digital literacy that has prompted me to approach this issue from a specifically Habermasian perspective.
I found it really interesting that you chose Habermas. I mean, mind you, I have not read a lot of him, but as you said, even, you know, nobody really has, as he does produce work very quickly. I found it interesting particularly because of his creation of his notions of the public and the private, and also how his particular conception of the private. Could you elaborate a little bit on how you think his conception of the public really interacts with how we've only addressed digitized citizenship as a digital thing and not necessarily as a democratic public thing, so to speak?
Mm-hmm. Yes, so Habermas has a theory of the public sphere, and his book, The Transformation of the Public Sphere, is the most central reference when discussing the transformation of the public sphere. That is that sphere of communication which connects citizens on the one hand with the government and political actors on the other hand. And presently we are also undergoing a transformation of the public sphere precisely because of processes of digitization that are taking place due to the use of social media and the internet, which have led to, among other things, a change from a one-to-many to a many-to-many form of communication. And this has led, among other things, to a fragmentation of the political public, the sphere in which we communicate with each other. And this, in turn, needs to be taken into consideration when we think about the way in which the public may be capable of generating democratic legitimacy. So in Habermas's work, the idea is that law is legitimate to the extent that it results from democratic discourses that justify the government's law. However, for these discourses to have this capacity to legitimate the law, the discourses need to be arranged appropriately and allow everyone more or less equal access to this discourse. However, when that equal access to discourse isn't existent, and if we have communicative structures that are in certain ways distorted because they privilege one actor over the other, then in turn these discourses are no longer capable of legitimating the law that the government then implements and imposes on all citizens and asks the citizens to comply with. So to the extent that we have a distortion of the public discourse generated through certain forms of communication that have resulted from processes of digitization, we may be in a situation in which the public discourse cannot fulfill its legitimizing function of the law. And as a consequence of that, the law that is actually implemented may lack legitimacy.
Very good point. Part of what I found really interesting about what you've mentioned in terms of fragmentation, to start off with that, is fragmentation to me seems like a very implosive action, whereas I thought it was a little bit more of a bifurcation in terms of polarities, because you do see fragmentation in the sense that the public has been sort of sectored off into different things based on certain echo chambers and confirmation biases that are produced through discovering political discourse or opinion online. I found the term fragmentation very well. I just thought that it was a bit more explosive in the sense, but I guess it's also fragmentation. But I also think it's interesting that in order to legitimate the activities of the public in a democracy, they need to be exposed to certain truths as well. And I think that you outline that very well in terms of like the post-truth regimes that we're currently facing and how that affects our ability to participate in government. My only question is, you mentioned the word appropriately, like what is the appropriate education that you should receive in order to participate legitimately? Because the thing is like, okay, so having grown up in Texas, you're exposed to a very particular regime of public education wherein post-truth is not really the issue because you don't receive that from online, but you receive that in the classroom where evolution is denied, where sex ed is glossed over, where the things that you learn are distinctly motivated by a certain corporate and political aspirations, I guess you could say, or intentions. And so that's already rooted in that political culture, not necessarily aided by social media. So I'm wondering, like, how would you assess what would be appropriate given that certain states already have these, like I'm thinking like any other state in the South, for example, seeing that they already have these agendas that have been predetermined by anterior politics that may have been radicalized or exacerbated by social media, but are still prevalent prior to it.
Yeah. So despite all the talk about digitization, it's important to be clear that many other issues of education and of citizenship education, democratic education, still continue to be very important, irrespective of the transformation of the public sphere, irrespective of social media and greater utilization of online services, online forms of communication. So the question you raise of the appropriateness of certain forms of religious education or certain denials of evolution within the curriculum of schools in southern states in the U.S. is still a very important topic to discuss, irrespectively of whatever is taking place online, whatever changes we see in the forms of political communication because of digitization. So the other questions about the role of religion in public schools within a liberal state are still very important questions. And so it's also no surprise that some of the most influential works in political philosophy, and I'm here thinking of John Rawls's Political Liberalism from 1993, actually discusses the role of religion in the public political culture and the question of how religious and non-religious citizens can peacefully, fairly live it on one another, given that we live in a society that is characterized by what Rawls calls the fact of reasonable pluralism, which is this idea that people who are rational will come to disagree on questions of religion, not because some are more rational than others or some are smarter than others, but rather because there is reasonable disagreement about these sorts of questions. And so religion is a very important role in our contemporary societies, and the role of religion in schools is something that needs to be seriously discussed, and we shouldn't be discussing only questions of digitization. That's absolutely correct.
Of course. Thank you for explaining that. The other thing that I found interesting about that, I mean, so as a I don't want to say Foucauldian because I don't want to give myself a certain moniker or anything like that. But as a Foucauldian scholar, I found it very interesting. I like anytime I see the word appropriate or anything that it's going to be brought about by a semi by or it's going to be explained through an explicit power structure, explicit or implicit power structure. I think it's very interesting. So I suppose continuing on the topic of education, one thing that I found was interesting, even though this is not really exact, it's not education in the exact same way. I was curious about what you described as like the media's lack of independence from economic and political imperatives and the citizens' failure to engage actively with ongoing political discourses.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to AUP Radio on World Radio Paris. Now back to Existentially Inclined.
So I wonder wherein lies the divide in that between the responsibility of the media to assure its public of its legitimacy in terms of truth telling and the citizens' failure, and like where is the line between social education and then public education in the sense that it's instigated or it's provided for by the political. And so if these two are independent, so essentially would you have like a checks and balances system where the media is independent and so you're taught by a certain educational schema to learn truth in a certain way and then you apply that to the media so you can fact check for yourself? Was that kind of the
mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so the approach that I'm using in which I call a Habermasian approach is mm-hmm. is a systemic approach. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that it looks at many different aspects of society and what is taking place in very different parts of society. So if we want to understand better the role that citizenship education has in digitized society, we should take into consideration economic questions, we should take into consideration cultural changes, political changes, so as to make an assessment as to what the current state of democracy is in Western societies, and we may want to make a distinction between European and North American societies and the way in which democracy is faring differently in these different regions. And paying attention to these different aspects means that on the one hand, we need to understand the role that social media companies play in the contemporary economy. And this economy is oftentimes referred to as a attention capitalism, which means that companies make money based on their capability to get the attention of users of their services and of their devices, as a consequence of which these companies have an interest in getting users, as it were, addicted to their products, as they have an incentive to make the users use their products as much as possible, which may or may not be beneficial for political communication. So we communicate by using these products, but these products are built so that we use them as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't necessarily mean that this will trigger the best result in terms of discussion that is oriented towards truth and towards justice. And now looking at the side of education and how we should prepare citizens and how citizens should react to this development. So first of all, citizens should be aware that when they're using these products, that these products have this inbuilt orientation towards using these products more and more. This is why we have like 5 or 6 devices for text messages. It's not because it's useful to have 5 or 6 devices for text messages. It's because people are making money by having us use of all of these devices, and the same for social media services that we use online. It's not the case that they necessarily render communication more effective. It's just the case that people are making money by having us use these products. So of course, we should also learn how to use them effectively, understand the tools that we can benefit from, learn how to craft effective messages, learn how to get information to social media, etc. But we also need to learn about the economic background conditions that structure the way in which these services are built in the first place. And that's part of what I mean by a systemic approach, an approach that tries to combine economic aspects with technological aspects, as well as with political and cultural aspects.
Cool. I only have like one objection to this, and I feel like this is something that a lot of people have said to me, or that I've actually noticed within certain family members, and here on campus as well, is that even if, like, for example, in our attention economy class last fall, we watched the documentary. It was put up by Netflix. Mm-hmm. The Social Dilemma. And what I found so fascinating about it is that people would watch it. For example, 2 members of my family watched it, and afterwards they went right back on their phones and were like, these things are bad, you need to watch out for this. And, you know, about a year later, they're still continuing in the same exact media consumptive habits. And the reason why I mentioned people on campus is that you can explain all of the economic and political drives behind Facebook, for example, and be like, look, they've patented are like aspects of our psychology and can determine parts of our lives. And then that's an actual patent. I forget the name of it. But the thing is that people can know the truth and then they engage in fetishistic disavowal and are just like, I know the truth, but what does it matter? Because if I can profit off of this, why would I not do that? Like that's something I've talked to a few people who are aspiring influencers on campus, and they're like, okay, yes, these companies are blatantly causing political turmoil just for the sake of receiving views and attention, as we saw with the whistleblower for Facebook a few months ago. But at the same time, like, I'm able to profit off of it, so why do I care what all of these things are? So I feel like even though you can't educate people against it, at the end of the day, like, if you think about how it engages with system one and two thinking, they'll always go to system one thinking, and they'll be like, okay, well, I'll just be, you know, I'll be a passive consumer because it's inevitable. So it's this kind of nihilistic fatalism that I think just needs, I'm not sure if you can teach that out of people or if it's just, I don't know, all already embedded in us, but it's, I think, cause like, I think this is definitely like a worthy endeavor. And I think that going forward, I mean, provided that we are moving into a techno scene, it would be fantastic to actually teach people how to engage with this sociopolitically. And it would probably lead to a better engagement, but the problem is I really think that people that, like, once you're scrolling, you're caught in this dire echo chamber and you have no desire to escape from a confirmation bias ultimately. Mm-hmm. But that I'm in no means mean to diminish any of it. I think that, like, that natural objection that people might have is a very deadly aspect to the propagation of the attention economy.
Yeah, so there are a few things I'd like to say about it. So one is taking a ancient philosophy point of view of Aristotle is to say there's akrasia, which is the weakness of the will. Mm-hmm. And that's just an aspect of human nature, that we understand something to be right, we understand we should be doing it, but then we actually fail to do it, even we know it would be the right thing to do for us. So that's no news, that's been with us for a long time. And the various ways in which we try to overcome this weakness of the will. And in the case of Aristotle, he thinks it can be overcome through a development of our virtues, that is, a development of our habits, the way we structure our lives, our routines, because if we only focus on one-off actions, we will too often suffer from weakness of the will, whereas if we focus on our routines and our habits and our daily structure, that's actually something that will effectively change our behavior. And I think that advice, although it comes from ancient philosophy, is still pretty useful and may even be compatible with newer developments in psychology. The other two points I'd like to make is that citizenship education shouldn't stop just at studying the economic background conditions of the way in which digital companies are structured and the incentives that they have and how this affects our use of these technologies. But we also need to think seriously about the political and especially legal tools that we may have at our disposal for confronting these problems. So citizenship education should then also focus on political, legal aspects and see what types of regulation would effectively address the problems that these companies have caused. And at the level of the EU and also in the US, we have seen that many changes in the regulations of these companies have already been made, and that these regulations may actually be effective in changing the way in which these companies change our lives. What this means is that a political response to the problem that these companies poses doesn't consist in changing our individual behavior, because our individual behavior doesn't really change how the companies operate, but rather taking a political stance and finding a collective solution that employs the tools of the law and of politics is actually more effective in bringing about the relevant changes.
I think that's a brilliant point about how collective and individual action do not always corroborate, especially when one of the individuals in and of themselves can be is corporatocracy, and in the sense that corporations are recognized as individuals under the 14th Amendment in the American Constitution. In any case, thank you very much for this conversation on digitized society. I found your paper very enlightening and also very optimistic about the future of education. I have a more Adorno opinion of everything, which is to say that I am a staunch pessimist, and I really, really hope that this that we really do adopt a lot of these practical measures in terms of teaching truth and the foundations of social media so that we can create better political citizens and sociopolitical citizens. All right. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you very much, Fiona. My pleasure to be here today.
All right. We'll see you next time with an interview with Professor Russell Williams about digitization and the effects of that on comparative literature in particular, and also on narrative, a topic which I am currently doing my thesis on, and I think it will be very interesting as a projection of human life from the Anthropocene to the Technocene. Thanks a lot. Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for listening to AUP Radio's 31st episode of the semester. If you'd like to hear more, you can tune in here on World Radio Paris every day, Monday through Thursday, from 9 to 10 p.m. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or even an idea for a show that you'd like to hear us do, you can DM us on Instagram. We're at AUP Radio. This episode was produced by Nicole DeSante, Clark Marchese, and myself, your host, Kira Roddy. Music by Vicate Studios. Enjoy your night.